Good day and welcome to the Beyond Detroit Media Webinar. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. John Cornwell. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Tricia. Good morning, everyone. My name is John Cornwell, and I'm the Practice Development Manager here at Plunkett Cooney. I have the pleasure of coordinating today's webinar, and just let me begin by saying how happy we are to have all of you with us today. Before we get started, I want to provide you with some background about the firm. Plunkett Cooney is based in Southeast Michigan and is one of the Midwest's leading commercial and public sector law firms with more than 160 attorneys in 9 Michigan cities, as well as one office each in Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis, Indiana. The firm has a tremendous amount of experience in governmental law and bankruptcy, two practice areas that are unfortunately front and center for us today due to the continuing financial difficulties faced by a growing number of Michigan's municipalities and school districts. Today's webinar, which we hope is really more of a discussion than a formal presentation, features two of the firm's most experienced municipal law attorneys and bankruptcy attorneys, Mike Bogren and Doug Bernstein. Mike, who currently serves as chair of the firm's board of directors, also serves as Plunkett Cooney's governmental law practice group leader. He's been practicing for 30 years now, and it was part of the Plunkett Cooney team selected by the state in 2011 to train professionals interested in serving as emergency managers. Doug is also a member of the firm's board of directors, and he heads up the banking, bankruptcy, and creditors' rights practice group for the firm. A former in-house attorney for Standard Federal Bank, Doug has also been practicing for 30 years now and has particular expertise in dealing with troubled assets in and out of bankruptcy. Doug joined Mike as part of that Plunkett Cooney team that helped train those emergency managers, potential emergency managers for the state. Today's webinar is really intended to give you a chance to, number one, educate yourself about some of the complex legal issues facing the state's financially distressed municipalities. And Mike and Doug will provide you with some opening thoughts about Public Act 4, which is the state's emergency manager statute, and Chapter 9 of the Bankruptcy Code, which is specific to municipalities. Before we get started, I do want to take care of a couple of housekeeping items. If you are still attempting to log into our webinar provider, startvisuals.com, and are having any difficulties, please make sure that you've turned off your pop-up blocker software. That sometimes prevents you from logging in, so check that and make sure that's turned off. And because we have a number of people attending today's webinar, we have asked our operator, Tricia, to help us during the question and answer portion of the program. So what we'll do is Doug and Mike will give some opening remarks, and then anyone wishing to ask a question will be placed into a question queue, and Tricia will come back on the line at that point to give you some instructions about how to ask a question through that queue. And one of the things she'll ask you is for your name and your organization so that we can announce you. Today's presentation is being recorded, and both the audio file and presentation slides will be available hopefully later today on the event page on Plunkett Cooney's website. So if you have colleagues that were not able to join us, please make sure you direct them to our website, which is located at plunkettcooney.com. So feel free to let your colleagues know, and we'd love to have them check out those resources once they're posted. Once again, on behalf of Plunkett Cooney, thanks for attending today's webinar, and now I will turn over the program to Mike Bogren and Doug Bernstein. Gentlemen.
Good morning. This is Mike Bogren. I'm going to provide an overview of Public Act 4, and then Doug is going to follow up with a discussion about Chapter 9 bankruptcies. The purpose of Public Act 4 is stated to basically allow a financially troubled governmental entity, either a municipality or a school district, to provide essential services in an uninterrupted fashion. Public Act 4 is the successor to a previous act that referred to emergency financial managers. Public Act 4 no longer makes a reference to emergency financial managers and instead references emergency managers whose authority is greatly increased over that provided to the emergency financial managers under the previous act. The intended purpose of the act is, as I said, to provide for uninterrupted essential services and also to protect the financial integrity of municipalities and the state itself. The act is rather extensive, and rather convoluted, to be honest, and I'm not going to go through every section of the Act. We don't have the time, and frankly, I don't think anybody has the inclination to hear that. What I do want to do, though, is touch on some of the highlights of the Act, particularly as it relates to some of the issues that are faced by several municipalities in the state right now. Upon the finding of a probable financial stress situation in a municipality, the state treasurer can appoint a review team. The review team has the authority to go in and go through a municipality's books and records and financial documents, interview people necessary to make an assessment not only of the current financial situation, but probably more importantly, the ability of the municipality to meet future obligations. One of the team's authority is to enter into a consent agreement with the chief administrative officer of a municipality. And when I refer to municipalities, I'm including school districts. The Act defines the chief administrative officer as a city manager, if there is one, or a school superintendent, or with respect to a city, if there is no city manager, then the mayor. Both the review team and the chief administrative officer have the authority to act independently and enter into a consent agreement. So in the case of the city of Detroit, for example, the mayor has the authority to enter into a consent agreement with the review team. However, the consent agreement has no actual power unless it is approved by the governing body of the municipality. So in this case, the city commission would have to approve a consent agreement that's entered into between the mayor and the review team. If the consent agreement is approved by the city council, the governing body, then the consent agreement will govern the future conduct of the city's financial business. Everything else remains in place. The mayor retains authority. The city council retains authority, subject to the terms and conditions of the consent agreement. If the consent agreement is not authorized by the city governing body, then the issue comes back to the treasurer, who can make a recommendation that the city be placed into receivership under Act 4. And receivership in Act 4 is different than a receivership in bankruptcy, which Doug will talk about. But when Act 4 refers to a receivership, what they mean is the appointment of the emergency manager. Any municipality that has an emergency manager appointed is considered to be in receivership for purposes of Act 4. So there are other ways in which an emergency manager can be appointed, but if a consent agreement is in place as between the chief executive officer and the review team, and that agreement is not ratified by the governing body, the result of that will be that the city is placed into receivership and an emergency manager will be appointed. An emergency manager can also be appointed if there is a determination of a financial emergency. There are a number of factors that the Act lists that can first, there can be a finding of probable financial stress. then there can be a finding of severe financial stress, and ultimately there can be a finding of a financial emergency. In the event that a financial emergency determination is made, then the governor appoints an emergency manager. Under the Act, the emergency manager has broad powers to rectify the financial emergency and to assure fiscal accountability of the local government. The emergency manager is compensated by the entity over which he or she has been appointed. The emergency manager also has the authority to hire professionals to assist in resolving the emergency financial situation. Those professionals are also compensated through the finances of the entity over which the emergency manager has been appointed. There's a bit of controversy in that. If a municipality is in an emergency financial situation, many have suggested that it should not be their responsibility to pay for the emergency manager and any professionals that the emergency manager deems necessary. The other side of that, though, and what the legislature ultimately determined, is that the state should not and would not pay for that, and that it was the responsibility of the municipality to compensate the individuals who are trying to resolve the emergency situation. Upon the appointment of an emergency manager, the existing governing authority loses control. If there is a city manager, the city manager loses any authority to act. If there's a mayor, the mayor loses authority to act, and the governing body loses authority to act. All the authority is vested in the emergency manager. Now, the emergency manager does have the ability to cede authority back to various bodies and boards. Typically, what will happen, for example, planning commissions and zoning boards of appeal will continue to sit, and the emergency manager will cede authority back to them. But in the absence of that, the emergency manager has the authority to make all decisions on behalf of the municipality. The emergency manager has a number of specific duties and authorities listed in the Act. The emergency manager is charged to analyze the factors and circumstances contributing to the emergency and to initiate steps to correct those conditions. There is also a specific provision that states, notwithstanding any minimum staffing levels that may be established by charter or contract, the emergency manager can establish and implement staffing levels. There are a number of municipalities that have passed charter provisions, for example, that require minimum staffing levels for fire departments. The emergency manager has the authority to override a charter provision that may say that 3 full-time firefighters are required on every shift. If the emergency manager determines that only 1 full-time firefighter is required, the statute gives the emergency manager the authority to override the charter or any contract that provides for minimum staffing levels. The emergency manager has the authority to reject, modify, or terminate one or more terms and conditions of an existing contract. That can include, for example, a contract with an outside provider to provide snow removal services. The contract may say that the city is obligated to pay for 50 days of snow removal. If the emergency manager determines that the city cannot financially bear that cost, then that amount can be modified unilaterally by the city manager. The city manager, and this is one of the more controversial provisions of the act, but the city or the emergency manager also has the authority, after conferring with the appropriate bargaining representative, to reject, modify, or terminate one or more of the terms and conditions of an existing collective bargaining agreement. And what that means is, after the emergency manager sits down and confers with the bargaining representative, if the emergency manager determines that certain financial requirements of a collective bargaining agreement cannot be sustained, the emergency manager has the authority to reject, modify, or terminate that clause. So if the bargaining agreement says that there'll be a 5% annual increase in compensation, the emergency manager has the authority to void that. The same is true with respect to benefits. The treasurer, the emergency manager has to obtain the approval of the treasurer's office to do this, but in the limited experience that we've had so far, the treasurer's office has not stopped an emergency manager from making any modifications to an existing collective bargaining agreement. As I said, this is an extremely controversial provision of the Act, and is one of the many challenges that currently pending to the Act, but the statute gives the emergency manager the authority. Some of the more draconian aspects of the Act: the emergency manager has the authority to make a recommendation to the governor to dissolve the municipality or the school district and to assign its assets, debts, and liabilities as provided by law. There are provisions that allow a city, for example, to disincorporate. The Act gives the emergency manager the authority to make that recommendation to the governor. Ultimately, the governor has to approve of that, but in the absence of Act 4, the process for disincorporation is rather involved and is not an easy thing to accomplish. The emergency manager also has the authority to recommend to the governor and the state treasurer that the entity be placed into bankruptcy. If the emergency manager makes a judgment that there is no reasonable alternative to rectifying the financial emergency, then the emergency manager can make that recommendation to the governor and the treasurer. If the governor approves the recommendation, the governor shall inform the state treasurer and the emergency manager in writing of the decision, and under state law, which Doug will talk about, the only time that a bankruptcy can be pursued by a municipal corporation in the state is with the specific approval of the governor. And Doug will now talk about what would happen in the event the governor gives approval for a municipality to go into bankruptcy.
First of all, thank you all for calling in today. Chapter 9 of the Bankruptcy Code is one of the chapters that typically you would pass right by when you're reading the Bankruptcy Code, and until the last couple of years, it is a chapter of the code that I can honestly say that I have never looked at. Chapter 9 is 11 pages total, including annotations in the code. In the history of the Bankruptcy Code, Chapter 9 has been used 576 times, with six of those filings having come in the last year. The challenge is it's somewhat of an unknown, and most of the analogies that are used are comparative to Chapter 11, which typically is a business reorganization. Some of the characteristics of a Chapter 9 bankruptcy, first of all, as Mike said, must be authorized by state law. In Michigan, the governor has to authorize it. In about half of the states, it is a requirement that the state legislature pass a law enabling a municipality to file. And one of the most recent examples was Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, whose petition was thrown out on the basis that it was not authorized. The city council there signed a resolution and filed the bankruptcy petition under Chapter 9. The mayor did not sign, and the petition was thrown out. Unlike a Chapter 11, a bankruptcy filing under Chapter 9 cannot be done involuntarily. In a Chapter 11, any three creditors can petition to have a business put into an involuntary bankruptcy. That is not the case with Chapter 9. It must be voluntary, and it must be done by the municipality. One of the key features of Chapter 9, which is contrary to any other chapter of the bankruptcy code, is when the case is filed, rather than being assigned to a judge by way of a blind draw, the judge who will preside over a municipal bankruptcy is assigned by the chief judge of the federal circuit court in which the municipality sits. So in the instance of Detroit or any municipality in Michigan, that decision is made by the chief judge of the Sixth Circuit who sits in Cincinnati, and the case may be assigned to any bankruptcy judge located in Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, or Kentucky. Now, conversely to the other chapters of the bankruptcy code, the role of a bankruptcy court in a Chapter 9 is somewhat limited because of the Tenth Amendment. There has to be a separation of the state exercising its right to govern and the use of the bankruptcy judge's powers. Therefore, it's more of a hands-off approach. There's a more limited role than you would find in any other bankruptcy proceeding under any other chapter. There are several technical aspects which are unique to Chapter 9. For example, one of the characteristics of a Chapter 9 bankruptcy, which is not the case in a Chapter 11, is that a municipality does not need the approval of a bankruptcy judge to sell its assets. In a Chapter 11 or in any other chapter of the bankruptcy code, any sale or borrowing outside the ordinary course of business requires approval of the bankruptcy court, and that's not the case in a Chapter 9. The municipality can sell off its assets. It does not need the approval of the court. The court cannot become involved in a municipality's day-to-day operations unless there is consent or the proposed plan of adjustment provides that the court take a more active role. It's not likely that anybody would agree or any municipality would agree in its plan that a bankruptcy judge would take a more active role, and there is under no circumstance would a bankruptcy judge interfere with the debtor's political or governmental powers or its revenues or property or the use or enjoyment of any of the income-producing property. The debtor may consent to have a court exercise its jurisdiction in many more of the typical areas where you have bankruptcy court oversight just to obtain protection. So rather than having a municipality make decisions on its own, the municipality would seek to have an order entered confirming the propriety of what they are doing. Judges don't typically like to do this. They call them comfort orders, which they don't like to issue, but it is provided for under Chapter 9. So, again, that's somewhat unique to this chapter of the Bankruptcy Code. During a Chapter 9, one of the unique characteristics is the municipality can incur additional debt. post-petition borrowings in a Chapter 11, for example, require the approval of the bankruptcy court, and there has to be some good reason for it demonstrated. That's not the case under a Chapter 9, and similarly, a municipality can sell or use or lease its property. So what's talked about, for example, in the instance of Detroit, would be the city leasing Belle Isle to the state. That would not need bankruptcy court approval in the event of a bankruptcy. The city could agree to do that, to enter into that agreement with the state. The city may also pay pre-petition debt after the filing, which is not permitted under a Chapter 11 or under any other provision of the bankruptcy code. Also, in a Chapter 9, unlike in a Chapter 11, for example, secured creditors cannot force the sale of assets to secure the payment of their liens, nor can there be reductions in expenditures ordered by the court or an increase in taxes. That would run afoul, again, of the 10th Amendment and would constitute an interference on the municipality's ability to govern itself. The court will not oversee the amount of debt incurred post-petition, nor would it authorize administrative expense status for unsecured credit obtained post-petition. And what that means, typically in a bankruptcy, in a Chapter 11, in order to continue to operate, a business would need financing after it files bankruptcy. And one of the methods in which post-petition financing is obtained is the lender who comes in after the filing of a bankruptcy takes an increased risk. Typically, the condition of that is they get a super priority lien and to assure repayment because they are taking on that risk. That's not allowed in a Chapter 9 bankruptcy. Again, in Michigan, there has to be a specific authorization under state law to file the petition in and of itself. I would say that in virtually 100% of the municipal filings in a Chapter 9 bankruptcy, something as simple as whether or not the filing is authorized gets challenged. So no matter what, it would be expected that if a municipality was authorized by the governor to file it, a petition in Chapter 9, there would be a challenge filed by somebody to it. And that is typical with virtually all of the Chapter 9 bankruptcies. Now, the eligibility requirements under Chapter 9 include the statement of qualifications that has to be affirmatively filed. It's a variety of things such as the municipality wishes to reorganize its debts. They must be a municipality. The state law authorizes the filing. The municipality must be insolvent as of the date of the filing. They must desire to effectuate a plan to adjust its debts. And then there has to be a showing of one of the following four requirements. One, that the municipality obtain the agreement of creditors holding at least a majority in amount of the claims of each class then the municipality intends to impair, and impairment for purpose of bankruptcy means change their rights under those which currently exist, under a plan. Two, that the municipality has negotiated in good faith with creditors but failed to reach an agreement. Three, that the municipality was unable to negotiate with creditors because it would be impracticable to do so. And then typically with that, being impractical to negotiate would mean, for example, if you are looking to modify, say, medical benefits of pensioners, you have so many in that class, it just doesn't make sense where you could sit down with each or a representative of that class where a negotiation makes sense. And finally, the fourth one is that the municipality would reasonably believe that a creditor may have attempt to obtain an avoidable preference. That element typically does not exist in a Chapter 9 because the wording of the law, frankly, is flawed, so that would never be an occurrence. The other unique characteristic of a Chapter 9 is that special revenue bondholders for which there is a revenue stream in a bankruptcy, the revenue for those special projects cannot be intermingled for other uses, so it cannot go into a general fund. If you are collecting a revenue stream dedicated to a specific project, the payments have to go to that specific project and cannot be used for other purposes. Also, unlike in other bankruptcies, a pre-petition lien in special revenue bonds is maintained after the filing of the bankruptcy, which is contrary to what happens in a Chapter 11, for example. The bond treatment is not given recourse claims. General revenue bonds are treated as unsecured creditors. So one of the main examples of that is a difference in the treatment of how the bondholders were treated in the GM and Chrysler bankruptcies, which was contrary to bankruptcy law, but they should be unsecured creditors here. So, in a nutshell, that is Chapter 9. I will say this as an editorial comment. You may want black and white, and it's gray. With that, Mike and I are available for questions.
Okay, Tricia, we'd like to open the lines for our guests to ask questions at this point. So, Tricia will give you instructions on how to do that.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that's star 1 at this time if you'd like to ask a question. Take our first question from Dawson Bell with Detroit Free Press.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you. I'm sorry. I guess in that last review of the bankruptcy law, I wasn't quite clear on whether you believe that Michigan law authorizes Chapter 9 for a municipality.
Dawson, Michigan law authorizes it with the approval of the governor. There's no specific statute authorizing a municipality to file bankruptcy absent a governor's authorization. But, again, I think my comment was about half the states require a specific piece of legislation to be passed authorizing it. Michigan specifically would require the governor's authorization.
I think you will go next to the line of Jonathan Osteen with MLife.
Yeah, hi. There's been a lot of talk, I know Elbrus Patterson in Oakland County has talked about how a bankruptcy in Detroit might affect credit ratings for the entire region. Can you talk a little bit about that and the implications that bankruptcy in Detroit would have for Southeast Michigan in general?
The way the credit ratings and the credit bond market works is in a public entity setting is that the raters do look at the entire region and the state itself for financial stability or the lack of financial stability. So in a typical situation, if a municipality, especially the largest municipality in the state, were to declare bankruptcy, that would have sort of a ripple effect, not only on communities in southeastern Michigan, but also for the state itself. The state's credit rating would be affected, and other municipalities that are in the bond market would also have a negative impact as a result of that. The closer you are and the more interaction that you have with a particular entity in bankruptcy, the more your own credit rating will be affected. I'm not one who does credit ratings, so I can't tell you with specificity, you know, how that process works. But the thought process behind it is, for example, Oakland County does have a number of financial transactions with the City of Detroit, wastewater, the water system, in a variety of projects that both participate in. So when the credit rating of one participant is affected, then the credit rating of other participants will also be affected.
Great, thank you.
Thank you again. That's star one if you'd like to ask a question. Please make sure that your mute function is turned off. Star one for questions. And we have no further questions. I'm sorry, we do have a follow-up from Dawson Bell with the Detroit Free Press.
Hi, thanks again. I think this is for Mr. Bogren. You mentioned that an emergency manager would have the authority to affect the benefits of municipal employees. Does that include pension benefits?
That's a very good question, Dawson. It's not specifically addressed in Act 4. However, the language is extremely broad, and it talks about any existing contractual obligation. I would suggest that in a situation where an emergency manager thought that the best way or maybe the only way to positively impact the financial situation is to change the benefits of pensioners. I think the Act can be read broadly enough to at least ostensibly give the authority to the emergency manager. Now, when an issue like that occurs, obviously there are other implications under ERISA, and it's not simply a matter of making a unilateral decision. And as with the other situations where the terms of a collective bargaining agreement would be affected, the approval of the state treasurer would have to be obtained. But the simple answer is that the Act is worded broadly enough that it would appear to give that authority to the emergency manager.
And I would follow that up with, if in the event of a bankruptcy, also unclear, but typically the approach would be you would not alter the pension rights of those who are already collecting the pensions. You would affect going forward the rights of current employees and the benefits. And typically what you would do is you terminate the pension, and then the usual approach is you go to something like a 401k, so it's not funded by the municipality. It's dependent upon the employees contributing. But the benefits can change, such as medical, but not the actual pension itself.
Okay.
I think you will take another follow-up from Jonathan Osteenfein with M Live.
Yeah, hi. So you've both talked about, you know, separately an emergency manager and what that might mean, and bankruptcy and that what that might mean. Speaking specifically about Detroit, can you explain what the benefits might be to one solution over the other? So what would bankruptcy mean for the city that an emergency manager couldn't do?
Well, for starters, you have the benefit. If an emergency manager is making the decisions, likely what you're going to get is any number of lawsuits being filed. And that devotes a tremendous amount of resources, potentially in any number of different courts, depending on what the issue of the day might be. The benefit to the bankruptcy court, to a bankruptcy proceeding, is all of the matters would be focused in front of one judge. The other thing that we're facing right now, and you can see what's going on with the multiple lawsuits, you've got at least two judges in Ingham County plus Judge Turnow in the federal court in Detroit looking at different aspects of the lawsuit. Now, many of these judges that have been assigned to these cases have no background whatsoever in business or in union matters. Judge Turnow was a sole practitioner who practice criminal law, and I don't know the backgrounds of the two judges assigned in Ingham County Circuit Court. When you're in a bankruptcy proceeding, you've got a judge who is not an elected official, who is used to dealing with business matters, all aspects of them, and with the bankruptcy code. Now, where Chapter 9 is a little bit different is, and this is an important thing to keep in mind, there has never been a bankruptcy in the Sixth Circuit, so the judge who would be assigned to this would have somewhat of a learning curve, too. So where some might believe that a bankruptcy would be a panacea and allow the city to move forward, that's not necessarily true. Anytime you're in a courtroom, anything can happen, and there is no predictability. But you would have the benefit of a judge presiding who is familiar with the code. The other thing, I guess, the overriding factor that gets discussed a lot is the stigma of the filing of a bankruptcy. But I guess the counter to that is both the city and the area right now are paralyzed by these ongoing proceedings. Every day is a new adventure as to what city council is going to do and what the courts are going to do, and things can't move forward. So much like what happened in the GM and Chrysler days, you would analogize it to Rick Wagner and Fritz Henderson saying GM will never file bankruptcy. Well, guess what? They did. They came out and they moved forward. So the upside potentially is, and I'll give you this as the overriding purpose of the bankruptcy code, is to allow an honest debtor to get a fresh start. It allows you to start over, clean up your balance sheet, and potentially improve your credit rating, which currently is not the case. So to me, that's where a bankruptcy, without advocating that they file one, that's where there could be some benefit derived.
Now, the potential downside of a bankruptcy as opposed to an emergency manager, in my view, has to do with the ability from a political standpoint to control the outcome. The governor has the authority to hire and fire an emergency manager at will. If the emergency manager is making decisions that the governor does not think is appropriate or actually has the effect of furthering the financial crisis, that a governor can replace the emergency manager. Once the case is in bankruptcy, you lose the local and even state level political control over what happens. Once you're within the authority of the bankruptcy court, you're in the authority of the bankruptcy court. Doug and I have spoken in the past, and I know there are bankruptcies under Chapter 9 in California that are still ongoing after 20 or 30 years. So that's something that I think needs to be taken into account, aside from the potential credit ratings impact, just the overall ability to control the potential outcome is significantly decreased once jurisdiction is passed to a bankruptcy court.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. We'll take another follow-up from Dawson Bell with Detroit Free Press.
Yes, thank you. Is it possible for you to, in that context of the loss of political control, though, is it possible to make an objective judgment about which structure, an EM or bankruptcy, would give whomever is in charge a better, the right number of tools or the capacity to actually restructure a city in a way that is likely to be successful?
I'm not sure that one can make an objective statement about that just because of the variables involved. Again, I think there are pros and cons to both. I think in terms of the emergency manager, the manager certainly has more authority to act independently or unilaterally than would be the case in a bankruptcy because, as Doug explained, the bankruptcy court cannot essentially take over the operation of the city. The city continues to operate. One of the main objections to Act 4 is that it essentially vests all authority in a single person. The upside to that is things will get done. The downside to that is a lot of people object to having their ability to impact the political system taken away because they can't vote for the people that are making the decisions. And just the overall sense that essentially you're creating a situation where all power resides in a single source. Again, that will allow things to get done quicker, but not necessarily in a way that it's going to please a lot of people.
Conversely, though, I guess in a bankruptcy, Dawson, the municipality would file what's called a plan of adjustment. In a Chapter 11 setting, it's a plan of reorganization. One of the distinctions, again, in Chapter 9 is only the municipality has the ability to file the plan. But in order to get approved, it's got to be voted upon by the creditors, and they need to meet the minimum standards for confirmation of that plan of adjustment. So it's a public document for all to see, and all those interested parties as creditors would have to vote on it. So you could actually track, you could see how the plan would be effectuated and how the various treatments of classes of creditors would play out. Now, one of the keys of the bankruptcy code, and this is true of Chapter 9 as well as Chapter 11, is similar classes of creditors have to be treated similarly. So, you know, you can't prefer necessarily how one union is treated, for example, over another with their union contracts. They have to be treated similarly if they are of similar classes. Now, there can be some gerrymandering around as to manufacturing separate classes in order to get a plan approved, but it's there for all to see.
And I should also point out that Act 4 does require a similar plan. It does require the emergency manager to prepare and have approved a plan to alleviate the emergency financial situation. And the emergency manager is required to make public reports quarterly as to the progress that's being made on the plan. The plan also has to be approved by the treasurer's office before it goes into effect. So I don't want to suggest that the emergency manager has unfettered discretion to do whatever comes to mind on a given day. Everything is supposed to be done in conformity to the plan that he or she puts into place when appointed.
If I could follow up, in a situation as you described in bankruptcy, in which the majority of the creditors reject the adjustment plan, what happens then? Does the court have the authority to impose its own remedy?
No. No. It just won't confirm a plan. And really what an approved plan of adjustment or plan of reorganization is, it's nothing more than a new contract. So if you have, for example, an agreement where you're going to pay any particular creditor 100 cents on the dollar, the plan proposes to pay 10 cents on the dollar because that's all you can afford. That's the new contract. And the same thing's true with union agreements, and you don't get approval until you meet the minimum requirements. And it's not in bankruptcy. There's such a thing as, and I don't want to get too technical, but there's such a thing as cram down, which is available to a municipality too. And what that means is you have at least one impaired class that votes in favor of the plan, but you also have to have 50% in number and 2/3 in amount of a class voting in favor of the plan in order to approve it. And I don't want to get too technical, but those are the kinds of requirements. But you can, the cram down provision is used sparingly, but done when necessary. So if you have one class, and that's why it's important in advance for the municipality prior to a filing of a bankruptcy to have a class already on board with their treatment. If you go in to a bankruptcy without anybody having already signed up, you're asking for chaos and a much longer, much more expensive proceeding.
Okay.
Don't know if that answered your question, though. And if not,
it's not going to be over today.
Truer words never spoken.
I have to run here. Thanks very much for your help, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, and at this time, there are no further questions in queue.
Okay, well, we're pretty much at our time, so as always, Doug and Mike are available, so if you think of something after the call, feel free to contact them. You have the contact information on the screen. And again, we will post our audio file and slides from today's program on our website at plunkettcooney.com. So on behalf of Mike and Doug and Plunkett Cooney, thank you very much for taking time to be with us this morning.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your participation. This will conclude today's conference call.